Hello, welcome to today's session on using and interpreting Tier 1 data to make instructional decisions. We're so happy that you guys were able to join us today. And my name is Kelly Steinmetz, and I am a regional coordinator for the Problem Solving Response Intervention Project, otherwise known as PSRTI. And we are so thrilled that we had over 100 people register for the session. We're super excited about that. We have people attending that are parents. We have out-of-state educators that have registered for today's session, as well as educators from districts, from very small districts to very large districts as well. So we have quite the variety of participants that registered for today's session, and we're so excited to see that. Also want to mention that after this session, we will have some resources available for you on our website. They will be located in a live binder under 2024. We will have a handout, so don't think that you have to write everything down. We will have a handout that accompanies today's session for some of the things that are going to be referenced today. So hopefully by the end of our time today, we're going to increase your knowledge of how to use and interpret Tier 1 data to make instructional decisions. We're also going to discuss frequently asked questions related to the analysis, interpretation, and the use of student data. So you might be wondering how we decided today's topic for our session. So every spring, our project sends out a needs assessment survey to our MTSS district contacts across the state. And we do review that data, and we try to look and see how we can best serve our districts across the state. And we want to make sure that we are meeting their needs. So we look at that. And if you're looking on the slide right now, you'll see some specific comments that were submitted during that spring survey that led us to decide that we wanted to focus our session's topic today on data, on using and interpreting data. So if you see, I'm going to give you guys just a minute to look that over, and then we're going to move on. Okay, so today's topic, of course, is in using and interpreting data. So what does it mean to use and interpret data? We want to talk about that it's very important that we use a variety of data sources, and it's very fundamental to MTSS. Data is at the heart of of everything that we do. So we want to make sure that we look at multiple data sources, lots of different types of assessments. That includes screening, that includes diagnostic assessments, that includes progress monitoring. All of those things are used in problem solving and decision making. And so we also want to make sure that we understand that we problem solve across all three tiers: Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. We also want to talk about that we use problem solving across all content areas. And we want to incorporate student outcome data as well as instruction and intervention fidelity data. All those pieces are very important, and we will touch a little bit more on those when we get started with our questions for today. So we have four panelists that have joined us today, and I'm going to give them an opportunity to introduce themselves, but I will start the introductions by saying Beth Hardcastle is our first panelist. Beth, would you like to say a little bit about yourself?
I would love to. Welcome. I'm so glad that you guys were able to join us today. My name is Beth Hardcastle. I'm a regional coordinator with the project. One of the OGs started with the project in 2007, and I serve districts across the northern part of the state. Prior to joining the project, I was a school psychologist in Santa Rosa County for 14 years. Going to give a quick shout out to my contact there, Sharon Patrick. And I also want to give a shout out to Dr. Amanda March. She's another OG with our project. She doesn't work with us anymore, but she's with us in spirit, and I'm glad she's able to join us. And I also saw Dr. Stephanie Martinez with the Florida PBIS project is on the call today. So just want to welcome our colleagues from other projects.
Thank you, Beth. And we have another panelist today, Dr. Carlos Blaine.
Hey guys, Carlos Blaine, Regional Coordinator, PSRTI. I am newer to the project, not the newest anymore. Kelly took that distinction from me. Prior to working with the project, I was an early childhood educator, spent most of my 20 plus years in the K through three realm, but also taught middle school and spent some time at the district level as well. So.
Okay, and our third panelist for today is Kelly Justice.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kelly Justice. I serve as the assistant director for the project, and I'm also a regional coordinator. I started with the project in 2007 with Beth, and before that, I was a classroom teacher for 10 years. I spent most of my career in Santa Rosa County, and probably just the very end of my career, I was in Pasco County as well. So it's really good to be here, and I'm glad to serve on the panel today.
Thank you, Kelly. And our fourth panelist for today is Pam Suddeth.
Hi, everyone. My name is Pam Suddeth, and I am the Learning and Development Facilitator for Literacy for the project. So I have the pleasure of supporting the state with everything literacy from pre-K through 12th grade. Really happy to be here. But before I came to the project, gosh, I'm rolling into my 14th year. That just can't be. But before I came to the project, I was actually a teacher, ESE, and also Gen Ed, and pre-K through 12th grade. I supported that as a literacy coach and also a district coach as well. So I'm really happy to be here with everybody today. So thank you for having me.
Thank you guys for all for being here. I do want to mention two other team members that we do have that are kind of playing behind the scenes roles today. We have Lisa Yont, who is a regional coordinator with our project, and she is going to be handling tech for us today and providing tech support. And then we have Dr. Shelby Robertson, who is also behind the scenes a little bit today too, and she is going to be helping us with monitoring the chat. So thank you guys all for being here today. So when we decided that we were going to focus on this topic, we started thinking about how we wanted to structure our session. And we determined that we wanted this session to be structured a little bit differently than our typical webinar. And so we wanted to have panelists, and we wanted to be able to have those panelists take turns in answering questions. And another thing that we decided to do is we wanted to have participants be able to put questions or submit questions during the registration process for the session. So we did have a handful of questions that were submitted that our panelists are going to be answering momentarily. And so we think that this is a very, you know, something that we're trying that's a little bit different. So hopefully it works out well today. The majority of our time together will be spent addressing those individual questions. The panelists are going to take those turns to do that. So majority of our session will be focused on those questions that were submitted previously during registration. If time permits, we may have time to address any additional questions that are posed in the chat box today. We're just going to kind of have to see how our time goes on that. All right, so we're going to go ahead and transition into our panel discussion section of today's session, starting out with our first question. And I'm going to direct this first question to Kelly Justice. We're a data-rich school district. How can we help educators choose the right data to analyze?
Wow. So this is a super question, and I guess kind of a good problem to have if you're data rich and you have so much data at your fingertips that it's really hard to make sure you're selecting the right assessment to yield the data to drive your decisions. And I think it's important to remember that when we think about problem solving or database decision making, that it is an inquiry driven process. So it's really the questions that we're asking or the questions that we want to answer that help us determine which assessment data we're going to select, especially again, you know, as the person who posed this particular question has a lot of data to choose from, so much at our fingertips. So we think about those questions that we want to answer with the use of data. A couple of examples might be, what percent of our students are currently meeting expectations? So we would select a data source that would help us answer that question. Another common question is, you know, if you're implementing an intervention for a group of students or individual students, trying to get a sense of, okay, so are the students, is a small group of students or is this individual student improving at a rate where I would expect him or her to catch up within a certain time frame? So those questions will help me select what data source I'm going to use in order to answer that question and drive my decisions. When you have a data-rich system, oftentimes an assessment map can come in really handy. And so assessment map, usually it's set up kind of like a table or a matrix, and it has different categories where you indicate the name of the assessment, obviously, what kind of assessment is, the type of assessment, maybe for what grade or ages it's appropriate, when it would be administered. So it's a nice way to just visually lay out the assessments that you have available within your school or within your district. And then members of that system, staff, educators can review that to kind of just get a sense of what is available, but then also think about those assessments in terms of which of these will most likely help me answer the question that I want to answer as an educator or my team or PLC wants to answer. Now, since we're focusing on tier one data based decision making today specifically, two common questions that we want to answer at tier one includes, is tier one sufficient for the majority of students? And a second common question is, who among our students needs additional support, a more intensive intervention? And so for those purposes, for answering those two questions, oftentimes screening data is an ideal data source that we can use, again, to just kind of get that bird's eye view, that sense of the degree to which tier one instruction curriculum is enabling students to meet our expectations, but then also to determine which of our students are in need of additional support in order to meet expectations. I do want to mention, though, the question talks about selecting the right data source, but keep in mind that we want to, whenever possible, triangulate our data or use data from multiple data sources, because the more converging data sources that we can use, the opportunities that we have to confirm findings that we may be able to glean from one assessment with a secondary assessment, just really strengthens our decision making. So whenever possible, think about using those multiple sources or triangulating data. I also wanted to mention, we have a Thinkific course that is available on our website. And the title of that is Appropriate Reading Assessments for Data-Based Decision-Making. And so if you want to learn more about the various types of assessments and what questions they can help you answer, that's a really great course. It takes probably about an hour to complete. I know we have a resource sheet and some handy links or helpful links and resources for you. And that will be included on that handout as well.
Thank you, Kelly. Is there anyone else that is on our panel today that would like to chime in or give their thoughts to this question as well?
I just wanted to reiterate what Kelly said in regards to looking at multiple sources of data, because we are such a data-rich state. We have so many options, and but I do think that that is so necessary to do that, in order to get a really clear picture. So thanks, Kelly, for mentioning that.
Thanks, Pam. All right, we're going to move on to our next question. So Carlos, I'm going to pose this question to you. How can my school efficiently problem solve when large numbers of students are in need of support?
Wow, that's a great question, Kelly. I think if we're looking at large numbers of students, tier one problem solving would be the most efficient way to address that. Tier one problem solving, of course, allows us to look at large scale data and kind of analyze it. And in this case, again, we're saying if it's large numbers of students and we're at that tier one level, we're going to look at that whole group data, one, to determine why so many students' data indicate that they need additional supports. But then we can also look at the response to the intervention and make a determination as to what supports we would put in place for them. So in order to do this, we would use that same four-step problem-solving process that everyone out there, I'm sure, knows and loves. The only difference here is we would have a different unit of analysis, right? So if we're looking at tier two supplemental supports, we would look at that small group response to that intervention data. If we're looking at tier three, more of those intensive supports, we're going to look at that individual response to that intervention data. But here at tier one, since we're saying this is the majority of students or large number of students, we would want to look at that whole group response to intervention data as part of that database decision-making process. So in order to do that, we would follow the same steps for problem solving, right? We would, one, want to determine the sufficiency of tier one to meet the needs of the majority of students so they could meet those grade level expectations. Two, we want to analyze some of those underlying causes of underperformance. So maybe we're looking for some prerequisite skills that the students are lacking, some of those barriers that prevent them, again, from meeting those expectations. So once we determine all of that, we would want to design a tier one intervention. Tier one intervention would be a universal change to that tier one instruction. So after we did that, we would want to monitor the RTI data. And of course, here it's going to be that whole group data. And then of course, we would just plan supports based on the student's response to that intervention. So I think it's really important to know that when we're implementing a tier one intervention, again, this is a universal change to that instruction. It's important to remember this does not stop nor interfere with tier two or tier three supports that we have in place. And I think just like when we put the tier two and tier three supports in place, they should enhance that tier one instruction. We would expect the same thing here. We would expect that tier one intervention that we have in place now, this should enhance those tier two and tier three supports. They should all kind of work in tandem together if done as part of a comprehensive intervention planning. And then I'd say, lastly, we have a course in our Thinkific called Tier One Problem Solving that everyone's able to kind of go in and check out if they wanted more information on that tier one problem solving.
Thank you so much, Carlos, for that very comprehensive answer. And I want to just open it up to the rest of the team and panelists to see if there's anybody else that would like to comment on this question in particular.
Carlos, I'm really thankful that you explained clearly that a tier one intervention is a universal intervention, and it's something, it's an adjustment that's made to that gen ed or core instruction for all of the kids. And I still think there's some misperceptions or some confusion across our districts where, and I see it in manuals and forms and paperwork, where a tier one intervention is listed for an individual student as though it's the first intervention that's implemented for a kid, rather than understanding that a tier one intervention, as you clearly and eloquently stated, is a change that impacts and that all students have access to.
Very good points, Beth. Is there anybody else that would like to add on to anything that's been said so far before we move on to our next question? Okay, we're gonna go on and move on to our next question. I'm having a little bit of difficulty with my forwarding of my slides, so I apologize for any delay. I'm gonna try a different way here to see if I can move forward. Okay, here we go. All right, so Pam, this question is going to be for you. What is considered best practice for training teachers to efficiently use and interpret data to make instructional decisions?
I'm so glad that I got this question. Thank you so much. So everything that I'm going to say actually touches on what Carlos and Kelly have shared so far. The best place, I will say, that educators can actually grow their learning and how to do that effectively and interpret data the most efficient way would be through professional learning communities that are pervasive all throughout our schools within Florida. That is the best place for job embedded professional learning. We all know that the one and done really isn't very effective because we want them to be able to take that data and examine it and grow with that. So we would say, and it's already been touched on, is to do that through a data-based decision-making through the problem-solving process. So as Carlos so beautifully said, it gives the opportunity for educators to look at their data, all the data that they've gathered, and identify those problems, and then determine the reasons why this is occurring. Look at those barriers, examine the barriers, and then look through and develop hypotheses of why this is occurring, and then validate those or eliminate the barriers that the educators are looking at for their students' progress. And then the next thing that they would do, of course, is design and implement an effective plan to say, you know, how we're going to be able to tackle this and work through this and design it in such a way that you can collect data to ensure this is happening. And then come back to say, gosh, is it working? You know, are we on our way? Are we closing those gaps to ensure that we're being able to support our students? That is the best place, number one place, I would say, for educators to be able to examine that and dig in. Yet there is another place that we can also do that. And this is, I call the golden nugget within a school, is the school literacy leadership teams, because those teams as well also maximize literacy achievement for all students across the school to really look at what's happening. And it's all based on data. They're all looking at that and examining it. But the beautiful thing about that is it's also looking at, you know, different content areas. It's looking at different grade levels. It's a whole team of folks, getting the teacher leaders, everybody getting together to say, how can we move our school forward in order to be able to do that, in order to make those informed decisions. So interestingly enough, and I don't think any of us will be surprised, but the K-12 reading plan actually supports this, and it is written in the plan for us to be able, and they help guide us through that process. And also what's found within that is the reflection tool. And the reflection tool is a tool that districts actually on a yearly basis come back and they report to the state of how well they're doing based on their data and their progress. So all of this together, the professional learning communities and the literacy leadership teams, those teams are essential to really examining data and growing our educators, really looking at instruction to ensure that we're meeting the needs of our students. I hope that answered the question.
Very great answer. Thank you, Pam. Want to also open it up to the team to see if anybody wants to add on to anything that Pam has already stated in regards to this question.
I'll just make a quick comment. I just appreciate the way that Pam really emphasize that existing infrastructure, because to your point, Pam, so many of our schools across the state already have professional learning communities in place. And so I think it's great to capitalize on that infrastructure that's already there within the school. And I like the way that you cited some specific examples for the literacy leadership team, respective to English language arts reading and so forth. But I just, you know, wanted to highlight and just reinforce for our participants that it's not unique to reading. Certainly we want to think about these opportunities for kind of in job embedded, on the job, learn as you do type of training and skill building. For other content areas as well. So the same coaching and skill building, knowledge building can occur, but you can focus on data and information relative to math and science, to behavior and so forth. But yeah, I just really appreciated you making those connections for folks to systems and teams that they may already have within their building or district.
Thank you, Kelly. I just want to open it up to anybody else before we move on to our next question. And also just want to remind the participants that we have on today that if we do have time at the end, we may be able to address any individualized questions. So if you are thinking as our panelists are answering these questions and you have this burning question that comes in your mind, you can go ahead and put that in the chat. We're not going to stop in the middle to answer those questions, but we may have some time at the end to address some questions. So feel free to go ahead and put in any questions as they come to your mind as we continue through today's session. And we are going to go ahead and transition to our next question. And this one is going to go to Beth. And our question is, how do we look at tier one data for trends and patterns?
Yeah, and you guys actually got a sneak peek to this question inadvertently. So yes. I think this is a good question to piggyback on the question that Carlos took or answered, in that the application of structured problem solving to tier one data. But as we're applying that process, it's helpful for us to look for trends and patterns that exist within those data sets. So for the purpose of this answer, I'm defining a pattern as a series of data that repeats in a recognizable way. So when we're looking at tier one data and looking for patterns, we may see patterns that are related to student outcomes or student needs. And those data patterns might give us information about the type of additional supports or that students need respective to what that data is assessing. But it also gives us information about our MTSS system itself. For example, if our data indicate that a lot of students are requiring tier two and tier three support, it lets us know that we can go back and look at that tier one data to get a better sense as to what we might need to infuse within that instruction or curriculum to bolster that, so that we are meeting the needs of kids, shoring up or making our tier one more effective. And so as such, it gives us information about our multi-tiered system of supports then as a whole, and some of the practices that may be related to that. It's important, if we're looking for patterns, to look for patterns that are specific, because that gives us better information as to how to adjust instruction so that it's most effective or appropriate for our students. An example would be if students take a particular assessment and 85% of them score within that proficiency range on that particular assessment, that's good information, that sounds positive. But if we dig a little deeper and look at the data and realize, even though 85% scored well, over 70% of the students who took that assessment missed the same three items that were related to a particular standard. So then it gives us an opportunity to dig a little further and determine then the ways that we can best support those students or augment that instruction or curriculum so that we are bolstering those their performance related to those items that and thus that standard. From a more global standpoint, we can look at data that may reflect demographic differences. That's why we encourage our districts and schools to differentiate or disaggregate data so that they're able to look at how subgroups are performing compared to that total or overall performance level. That gives us information and lets us know that there may be certain subgroups for whom tier one instruction and curriculum isn't meeting their needs, or that there's a misalignment there that we can then make instructional adjustments for. Another way that we can look at data more globally would be to look at historical trends in data. And one way to do this would be looking at cohort data over time. So cohort data gives us information, not just about student performance, but if we're looking at cohort data across time, more from a historical perspective, it gives us a better sense as to who's succeeding, who's falling behind. And it gives us some idea as to where in that educational pipeline students are starting to falter. So that can provide good information, again, for that tier one problem solving. So for example, schools could look at, or districts could look at, how third graders in that district are performing against certain assessments year after year after year. Or you could look at a particular cohort and follow that cohort year after year and look for trends and patterns within that particular cohort to get a better sense as to where instructional adjustments might need to be made. in addition to academic data. And I'm glad Dr. Stephanie Martinez is on the call with us today, because the example I think of there is how the Florida PBIS project takes tier one data and just does amazing things with showing patterns and trends in that. And any of you who are PBIS districts, and in particular access the PBIS database, you see that data is grouped according to where behaviors are occurring, or where misbehaviors are occurring most frequently, where what time of the year are misbehaviors occurring, what time of day are misbehaviors occurring, what types of misbehaviors are clustered together or showing up more often than others. So that would be another way that we can use Tier 1 data to look for those trends and patterns and make decisions about how best to support students and staff.
Thank you, Beth. I love that you brought up at the very end there about that PBIS data and looking at that data on a tier one school-wide level. As a previous PBIS coach for a pre-K through eight school, we relied heavily on looking for those trends and those patterns in relation to the data that we were receiving about, you know, what time of day was a lot of our behaviors, you know, referrals being written for, you know, where was the location that a lot of these incidents were happening. And that way we could provide supports school-wide to try to reduce that. So I love that you brought that up. That was a great example. And I want to go ahead and open it up to any of the rest of our team to see if they wanted to expand any on this question before we move on.
Just want to add, Stephanie Martinez just put in the chat that they have added attendance data to their database that's going to show data or attendance patterns that are greater than 10%. I think that's what she said. Yeah, 10% of the days.
I'm sure that's something that will be greatly used by our school sites and districts as well when they're looking for those trends and patterns and helping to improve their attendance. Did anybody else on the team, thank you for sharing that, Beth, and monitoring the chat box over that. Is there anybody else that wanted to add anything to this question before we move on to our next one? Okay. Well, I'm going to hope that my slide forwarding works appropriately, and we're going to go ahead and move on to our next question. All right, great so far. Okay, so Carlos, this one's going to be for you. How do we make database decisions when instructional fidelity is a concern?
I think this one's a good question for me. It reminds me when I started teaching in the last millennium, back when FCAT was the law of land and we had like our new teacher orientation group and we were given mentors and we would meet and we would have discussions. And whenever we did an assessment, we would do like an item analysis of the assessment. I can remember sitting in a meeting, talking to some of the teachers who were new like myself. And we had a conversation of how low our kids were because they just were not getting it. And so we thought at this meeting, they were going to give us some magic formula that would make the kids get it. And instead, they started talking to us about classroom management, the way we were delivering instruction and things like that. So I'd say any questions about instructional integrity make it very difficult for us to use student response to intervention data as part of that database decision-making process, because those decisions really rely on the fidelity of instruction. I'd say we would want to rule out instructional fidelity as a primary concern when students aren't making the progress that we would expect them to make. Say probably one of the best ways to prevent this is just doing some comprehensive intervention planning, right? And so when we're thinking about that comprehensive intervention planning, we want to detail what supports we're going to put in place. Of course, there's a rationale for those supports. Who would provide those supports, when and where they would be provided for the students, and then how we would measure fidelity. So if we have all that things in place, I think it makes it a little bit easier. And again, it's part of that comprehensive plan. We're more likely to kind of check off all those boxes and eliminate some of those fidelity concerns. Now, if the progress monitoring data indicates, and this is where we had one of those mind shift moments as new teachers, if that data indicates a questionable or poor response. Of course, the district knew way back then that we need to investigate, you know, the fidelity of instruction. So the very first question that we would ask in situations like that, again, with that questionable or poor response, was the instruction provided with fidelity, or was it provided as it was designed? And if the answer is no, then of course we want to take steps to improve instructional fidelity. And so some of the things that we did that you all could do, there was tons of training, there was coaching, feedback can be provided to your instructors or your interventionists. We can map resources that you have at the school, as well as barriers to the provision of those supports that you've identified your students as needing. One of the things that they did that I think is really important, they always tried to solicit teacher input. So they would talk to teachers about the implementation supports that they needed. And then it's important to remember what we learned. You can only confidently make database decisions after improving instructional fidelity concerns.
Thank you, Carlos. I like, this is always a difficult conversation and a difficult question when we have to, you know, as professionals and as teachers, look back at ourselves and maybe our own instruction and really reflect back on maybe some things that we could do differently or we might want to do, you know, a little bit better than when we first taught possibly, you know, a particular standard, because if a majority of our students didn't understand it or didn't score well on whatever assessment that we gave for that, then we definitely need to look back to say, you know, how can we reteach this, you know, in a different way. So I appreciate that you brought that up, and I want to open it up to the team to see if they have any additional comments that they would like to make in regards to this question.
I think it's been well stated thus far. I love the emphasis on putting in as part of that comprehensive intervention plan, because we think about, and rightly so, of the supports that we're going to provide the student. But the nice thing about approaching that in a more comprehensive manner, you think about the supports that you're going to provide to the educator who's agreeing to take responsibility for providing that instruction. And so I think that can set the instruction or the intervention, regardless of tier, and they really set that up for success. I also like what Carlos said about getting teacher input, because if we approach the use of fidelity data to make good decisions and the collection of those data in a very standardized way, like that, this is just the way we do business, this is how we educate students on our campus or across our district, then it's a clear expectation and people know that from the outset. And then enroll the teacher's input as far as, you know, we have multiple options for how we can measure fidelity. What are your thoughts about the best way in order to accomplish that? I think you can get a lot more buy-in, and you can help them select a measure that really matches the instruction they're providing, as well as just their personal instructional approach. And I think that, like you said, Kelly Steinmetz, that very sensitive topic can be much easier if you're having that open conversation with the teacher and really enrolling their input and support on that.
I think that Carlos's answer and Kelly, what you just said, gives us good information too about that there are different types of fidelity. So I can implement a particular intervention or a particular instructional practice with fidelity. And it may mean that, am I including all of the pieces and parts? Am I following all of the steps that are part of this intervention? But we can also talk about fidelity that's related to processes themselves. And did we engage in problem solving with fidelity? Did we develop a comprehensive intervention plan with fidelity to include those support pieces and assessment considerations? So I think the information that's been shared gives us the sense that both types of fidelity are important.
Thank you, Beth.
I also want to jump in, Kelly, before you wrap
up, because go ahead.
I think it's going to tie everything in a perfect bow, is the fact that it is so essential to ask the teachers. And I'm so glad that that was brought up a couple times. And a great way to do that as well is even just providing them a short survey or a belief survey about what they believe about that, and to be able to provide their input and have their voice in it, because it is so essential to do that, because they may not even have a belief that it's going to work, you know? And so if an educator, like, you know, starts sharing that information with students and they really don't understand, or they don't believe in it, it's like having those thoughtful conversations, it kind of brings it all together as well, so that we're all on the same page for our students in order for them to progress. So very nicely done. Great team, guys.
Well said, Pam. Thank you for tying it all up in a bow for us there before we move on to our next question. Okay. So our next question, when our data, universal screener, indicate a need for intervention in the areas of comprehension or vocabulary, what can we use for progress monitoring? And Pam, this is going to be the perfect question for you as our literacy specialist for the project. I'm going to hand this one over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. You know, first of all, I want to say that, you know, the best place to start, of course, is not only with the curriculum that was purchased, is because there are some, you know, embedded assessments and progress monitoring to be able to look in those areas. Also, districts have created common assessments to be able to look at that effectively, as well as benchmarks, you know, so those are some areas to really look at. But then when you think about a screener itself, it's really looking at the progress that the students are making, that if they're going to meet, you know, end of the year grade level standards, to be able to see if they're going to be effective. And it also identifies, and I know Kelly mentioned this earlier, it identifies students who may need a little bit more support. And the focus here, of course, is with comprehension and vocabulary. But the best place to do that is to really, if you're going to dig in deeper, once you've taken in and looked at all of those, the assessments that you have and the data that you've collected, is to really consider, you know, your evidence-based programs that were purchased, because these programs align with not only the six components of reading, but obviously vocabulary and comprehension are also included in there. And they offer tools, consistent tools, progress monitoring to see if students are going to be able to close those gaps and if they're on track for meeting those, to being able to meet those needs that they have. And there are guidance, of course, within the K-12 reading plan. Again, I'm all about that, because they offer the different types of data that we should be examining to be able to help guide instruction, but also to be able to differentiate for our students, to be able to ensure that we are meeting their needs to inform instruction and intervention, not just within tier one, but across the tiers as well. And I want to suggest, and I know that this has been mentioned also a couple of different times, so if we're looking at, gosh, I don't know that we have the data and we need to be able to examine more, I just want to offer up that the National Center on Intensive Intervention actually has toolboxes for not only the screeners, but progress monitoring and diagnostic assessments that can give you a clear picture that is truly in alignment with the needs of the students. Because if it's not in alignment with, if your program, if your support, if it's screaming for, oh my gosh, we need more vocabulary, and you don't really have anything to be able to support that, then we might need to go and examine, gosh, you know, what other evidence-based programs or support do we have or do we need for our school or our district? And a great place to do that is FCRR actually has a reading program repository, and it's online. You click, you put in these filters and find out your grade level and what you're looking for, and it will pop up some amazing evidence-based programs that are, you know, not only provided in the state of Florida, but they're being used consistently, or they wouldn't be on that repository. So that's a really great place to go. And the third place, and this has been mentioned, and it really aligns beautifully with Fidelity, which is the question before, is if you're thinking about, you know, the effectiveness of instruction, yet again, FCRR, they have that school literacy leadership walkthrough that really is in alignment with our standards. And it really teases out what educators for instruction should be doing within their classroom to have those thoughtful discussions about, gosh, you know, it's in alignment with my practice profile. Am I really, you know, providing my instruction with fidelity? And what areas do I need to shore up, or heck, which ones are the ones that I'm knocking it out of the ballpark? So those are just some great other resources that we're just, you know, hopefully I know we're going to share those, right, Kelly, to be able to help guide and support you. So we're also here as a team to the project. So if you have any other questions, so please let us know.
Thank you, Pam. And just want to throw it out really quickly to the team before we move on to our next question. Any final thoughts? All right, we're going to transition to our next question. Beth, this one's going to be for you. How can high school educators use Tier 1 data to determine if Tier 2 intervention is needed and develop the necessary supports?
Thank you, Kelly. I like this question. And when my first response to it is, I don't think that high school educators can do that until some other things are in place. I think back to early years in our project when we approached our work as more of a systems change model, and one of the systems change theories that we used in our trainings was that notion of consensus, infrastructure, and implementation, and that we had to have buy-in and consensus in order for that change effort to take hold. We had to have the infrastructure pieces in place in order for educators to do the things that we were asking them to do, and that those things needed to precede then some actual implementation of new practices. So at the secondary level, I think it's important for leadership teams to consider, do we have consensus? Because there are some secondary folks who don't see an MTSS infrastructure as appropriate for the secondary level, that it's something that is done or belongs at the elementary school level. So helping secondary leaders and educators, do they believe that a multi-tiered system of support infrastructure can really improve student outcomes for their secondary students and improve graduation rates? So I think that the consensus piece is important. I think that Tier 1 data sources is important. In a secondary setting, not all grade levels are administered a universal screener. So in order for us to have Tier 1 data that allows us to know which students might be in need of Tier 2 support, then my suggestion is that universal screeners are administered to all students and not just some. So that would be that would become then a Tier 1 data source if schools have an early warning system infrastructure that would provide Tier 1 data that would be a good source of information. Attendance data, behavior data, student engagement data would also be data sources that would allow teams to be in a better position to make decisions about who needs Tier 2 support. And the other component related to infrastructure would be an intentional practice related to structured problem solving. So is there time built into the schedule for that? Are there people at the secondary level who have been trained in data-based problem solving and the steps that are embedded in that? And so I think in order for high school educators to get to the point where they can use Tier 1 data to make Tier 2 intervention decisions, is there's got to be consensus and buy-in. There's got to be the infrastructure in place with respect to scheduled problem solving time and trained staff, and then just access to Tier 1 data sources.
Thank you, Beth. You brought up a lot of great points. And then answer, we are, I think we do have time for one last question that was submitted. And so I'm going to ask Kelly Justice to answer this last one. And it is, how do we use diagnostic assessments to inform Tier 1 instruction?
Yeah. Thanks, Kelly. This one actually comes up a lot when I'm out in the field and working with districts and schools. So I'm really glad that someone submitted this particular question. I think that it's really important for our participants and educators across the state to understand the difference between a diagnostic assessment and maybe a diagnostic report or a type of screener that has some diagnostic or yields some diagnostic type information as far as strengths and weaknesses that might be provided by a publishing company or a test maker. Because there is a difference between, let's say, a diagnostic report that might be yielded from a screener versus a true diagnostic measure. So an authentic diagnostic assessment is a very in-depth assessment. It's designed to identify specific strengths and areas of weakness relative to a particular skill or skill area. And it should also yield information as far as which skills for this student should we target and really hone in terms of more intensive intervention and instruction. They're typically administered one-on-one and typically administered to those for whom screening data indicate that there is some level of risk. So students that who are at risk of not meeting expectations unless we provide and intervene with some more intensive supports. Now, with enough time and enough personnel, you could certainly administer a diagnostic at the Tier 1 level for all students. Again, that's going to be an investment in time and personnel in order to do so. If you did that, if you had the capacity to do that, to administer a diagnostic for all students, then you could use that data to then identify skills and areas that you would want to target through, again, talking about Tier 1, whole group instruction, a universal change, right, that was mentioned earlier and relative to one of our other questions, or through differentiation, through differentiated instruction. Again, both of those would be informing what all students get, either through that whole group instruction or through differentiated instruction. More often, though, because so many of the schools, at least that I serve, have limited capacity, they're not always able to administer a diagnostic to each and every student. More often, I see it administered after a screener, after we've identified some of those students who may be at risk of not meeting expectations if we don't implement some type of more intensive supports. Again, I'm going to plug that same course again that I mentioned in my first response. It's the appropriate reading assessments for database decision-making. So it's appropriate reading assessments for database decision-making. And it is specific to reading, but I do want to let you know that so much of the information and the concepts that are shared within that course are easily translated into other content areas. So don't be off put by the idea of, oh gosh, I was really hoping to dig into some other content areas. I really do think that some of that information is easily translated into math, science, and some of our other content areas or courses.
Thank you so much, Kelly. And I do want to open it up to the rest of the team. We do have a couple of minutes before we need to transition to our wrap up. If anybody else has anything that they wanted to add in regards to this question, go ahead.
I would like to add that when it comes to administering a diagnostic assessment, even though those are considered an individually administered norm reference test, that if the test is being administered to a student for the purpose of informing instruction or intervention, parental consent is not required. Parental consent is required only when that diagnostic test is being administered as part of, once we're now looking at evaluation for special education than it is. But if it's administered along the way, just to inform instruction and intervention, consent from the parent is not required.
Thank you so much, Beth, for those final thoughts as we transition and we get to the end of our time together today. I would like for you guys to please take a moment to complete our session evaluation. Your feedback is very important to us. If you are a person that does not prefer to use a QR code, I'm going to ask Shelby, and I think she went ahead and put it in the chat as well. There should be a link in the chat box if you prefer to use that instead of the QR code. I am going to pause and give you a couple of minutes to complete this really brief survey. We do look at this information. We do use it for planning, as we mentioned at the beginning of how this session came about. We do look at these, our data, and we make decisions based on that to improve and make improvements. So please take a minute. I'm going to stop talking for a moment, and then we're going to transition to our last slide. But I want to give you a minute to complete that evaluation. All right, so hopefully you had an opportunity to access that link in the chat box. And we have just a few moments left together. Wanted to point a few things out that we have. I didn't see any questions coming through in the chat box. So we had a pretty quiet group here today. But I did want to point out on this slide that we do have our link to our website here on the slide. And that is going to be helpful to you because as of this afternoon, we will have some resources in relation to this session uploaded, and it's going to be in the PSRTI presentations live binder. There will be a tab that says 2024, and then you will see the title of this session today, and that's where you will be able to access not only the presentation in a PDF format, if you want to review what those questions were. There will also be a recording available, and of course, that handout that we mentioned at the beginning that has some great links that have been referenced today by our panelists, that is something that will also be uploaded as well. So there will be three things and three resources from today's session for you to be able to access from our website. So please make a note of what our website address is so that you can go back in and once again, look for that PSRTI presentations live binder. It under the tab of 2024 is where you're going to find that information. I don't think we had anything in the chat box, but I do want to defer really quickly to Shelby because I have not been monitoring it as closely as I would like to. Shelby, are there any lasting questions that were submitted that we want to address as we have a couple more minutes?
I don't see anything, and it's been really quiet in the chat box. So.
It is. I was very surprised because, you know, we had quite a pretty good group. I think we had 51 people in the room at some point. And usually, you know, in regards to data, there's always lots of questions. So I really expected to have a plethora of questions at the end of the session in case we had some time to be able to address those. But you're right. Quiet group today. I really thank everyone for being with us today, taking the time. Again, if you have not taken a minute to complete that evaluation survey, please do that. Do so now. We appreciate it. We will review it and look for ways that we can improve in the future. And hopefully you enjoyed this structure of our session today, which again is a little bit different than our typical webinar that we have. And we wanted to preserve as much time as we could to answer your questions that were submitted ahead of time and use our panelists to do so. So thank you again so much for coming. I see a lot of thank yous happening. I'm looking at the chat box now and I see a lot of thank yous for the session. So it's great to get some positive feedback. And thank you again to the panelists for your time today and willingness to answer these questions that were submitted by participants when they registered for this session. I hope everybody has a great afternoon. Just want to make sure there's no more. Oh, Krista Hillman was in the room. Somebody that I used to work with when I worked in Monroe. Always great to hear a friendly shout out. We have about one more minute left. I'm just going to stay in the room, make sure that we don't have any lingering things happening in the chat. All right. Well, we have come to the end of our time together today. Hope that you gain some information that you can move forward with. And please go ahead again and check out those resources that should be uploaded by the end of the day today at our website under that PSRTI Presentations Live binder under the tab of 2024. Mm-hmm. Have a great rest of your day and afternoon. We'll see you soon. Bye.